Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. You know, birdwatching has become a truly beloved pastime in the United States and really around the world. And if it wasn't for the invention of the Peterson Field Guide series, I'm pretty sure we would not be where we are today when it comes to birdwatching and just enjoyment of nature in the out-of-doors. Today, my guest is author Elizabeth Rosenthal, and she has a book out. It's a reprint of a book that she first wrote, had published, I think, in 2008. The book is titled Birdwatcher, The Life of Roger Torrey Peterson. What a guy. Elizabeth has published birding articles in Birdwatcher's Digest, the New Jersey Audubon, Snowy Egret. She's the author of also the acclaimed the book His Song, The Musical Journey of Elton John. Elizabeth, so glad to have you with us today. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really thrilled to be here.
I tell you, your book, and I've really enjoyed reading your book, and it opened to much acclaim when it first came out in 2008, and now we've got a reprint.
Right.
Tell us why and how.
Well, what happened was it initially was put out by the Lions Press in Connecticut, which was an imprint of Globe Pequot, but then there was a corporate takeover. And Roman and Littlefield took over the Lions Press and Globe Pequot, and it couldn't have happened at a better time because Birdwatcher had just gone out of print, so now it's back in print again, and I was able to update it a little bit too.
Well, it's a great read, and I can't believe I didn't get interview you the first time around.
Better late than never, and in any case, no time is really late. I mean,
no.
I love to talk about Roger Torrey Peterson. I love to talk about birds, and I'm very happy that you're able to, open up your program to me.
And there are so many Wisconsin connections, too, which we'll get to as we kind of go through the book, but I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. Questions for Elizabeth Rosenthal about Roger Torrey Peterson, the field guides and everything else, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You know, this book is it's amazing detail, but done and written in a way that is very entertaining, to be perfectly honest. What inspired you to write a book about Roger Torrey Peterson?
Well, it's kind of weird. Basically, I'm sort of late to the birding pastime. I only really started getting into it when I was 42, which was 13 years ago. And I don't even know how it happened, but I just started noticing birds. And then the first time I went into a nature center, a local nature center, the Peterson Guide was recommended as a guide for me to get, so I did. And at some point I noticed that there hadn't been a new biography of Roger since around 1976 or 77, and that one was an authorized biography. And I thought, boy, you know, he certainly deserves another one and something more sweeping in scope. And it also covered his whole life and not just his life up to the 70s.
Yeah, I'm really glad you wrote it, and I'm sure a lot of other people are as well. He's, it's always Roger Torrey Peterson and his middle name was what? His uncle's first name?
Yeah, his uncle's. He had an uncle named Torrey, who lived, I guess, not too far from Jamestown, New York, in Oil City, Pennsylvania. So it is apparently a Swedish name, and it's a wonderful name. It's great that I don't think his parents realized what a gift they gave him, having that sort of a, you know, very majestic three-part name. It's just perfect.
For a majestic guy that kind of carried himself as a majestic guy as well.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of people don't realize that he was so much more than just a field guide author or a birder. He was literally a guru of birding and natural history in general. He was a very passionate conservationist. He also was an international figure. And basically, during most of the time that he was active, he was really the one guy in the entire world that people looked to for conservation concerns, as well as talking about in different bird species and habitats, and he was he ended up being very active in many, many different groups, and he was even an officer in the American Ornithologists Union, which now is just for professionals, so-called professionals, but at the time, amateurs were very welcome, but he was a very, very well-schooled or self-schooled naturalist.
Well-schooled and self-schooled, you've got it right there. I love the one story you told, and this was fairly early in the book, I don't remember where, but attesting to his abilities, he was taking a group out, and they get out to an area, and he just lays down and shuts his eyes.
Right. And they didn't know why he had done
this. What he was doing.
Yeah, they thought maybe he was just being rude and taking a nap or something. But no, he lay down and he shut his eyes and started listening for the different bird songs and bird calls. And then after that, he explained that he'd be able, what he had done. And then he took everybody to see those very birds that he had just heard. And as a matter of fact, there was a story. I think it was there was the International Ornithological Congress in the late 50s in Scandinavia, where all the European ornithologists and birders actually turned to him, and he had only become familiar with European birds for maybe 6 years or so, and they turned to him to find out what bird was singing in the forest. And it's just amazing. He was such a fast learner.
And as an artist, well, he was an artist and also a photographer, extraordinary photographer as well.
Right. He had an enormous passion for photography, and it seemed like, especially in his later years, that photography was a way for him to get away from the drawing board, essentially, I could go on about this for quite a while, but basically, over time, he felt that because he had to keep updating, or he felt he had to keep updating his field guides because he wanted to stay competitive and current, he felt like he was actually chained to the drawing board. And so he was delighted whenever he had an opportunity to go on a trip with, in many cases, younger admirers, and take his camera and just snap away, and he was very good at watching birds through the camera lens.
Yeah, he was outstanding. You know, his the philosophy that he had in developing his books, I thought was really interesting in terms of helping people identify and being able to very succinctly, because you couldn't go on and on.
No. Well, in fact, in general, the bird guides that had been out, they were either more, academic manuals, or they were just sort of nice little things to thumb through, but didn't provide much information. The problem was a lot of publications would just go on and on about every last feather of the bird, and by the time you finish reading the description, you would have no idea what the bird actually looked like. or you'd have the opposite, where the bird would be written about in a kind of a fanciful sort of folktale way, and again, you wouldn't really find out what the bird looked like or what it did or where it lived. So Roger decided to boil everything down to the essentials of what you would need to see in the field in order to identify a bird. And he came up with a fantastic system that was partly influenced by Ernest Thompson Seton.
Yes, from Two Little Savages.
Right, Two Little Savages, an unfortunate name for a book, but
yeah.
In any case.
It was a diagram of ducks that he did, I think.
Yeah, he did. Seton drew a diagram of ducks all facing in the same direction and just showing what he called their uniforms so that you would be able to identify them in the field. And Roger just took that and he ran with it. And clearly, and this was a book that he loved. And so he basically did that with all birds. He would have them all facing in the same direction, all proportionally sized, and all similar type birds, so that you would be able to see the differences amongst the different similar birds. And his intention was to make them make his field guide completely user friendly and get people who had no knowledge of birds to be interested in birds. And that's much more important than, you know, describing
every last detail.
Yeah, exactly.
And boy, did he succeed. I was his first, what it was, I think his first guide had 2,000 copies, the first printing or something. It was what?
Right.
2 weeks or a week or something? It was sold out.
It sold out very quickly, and they were kind of taken by surprise. And it was strange, too, because it wasn't a cheap book by the standards. I think it was $2.50 or something, and it was, you know, when the Great Depression was really at its worst.
Yeah.
And somehow or other, the book hit a chord, and from there, you know, Roger never really looked back. I mean, he continued with field guides. He got a job with what was called the National Association of Audubon Societies, and became really the bird's ambassador to America from that time on.
And he had a wife too. Aside from that, I mean,
he was
married three times. So.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah. The first one was the shortest lived.
Yeah.
Mildred Washington. They married in the mid 30s and got divorced in the early 40s, and then he married his second and really his most important wife and his most important, female companion of his life, Barbara Peterson, who was very, very intelligent and also very vivacious and full of energy, and the kind of person that she had to be with him in order to keep up with what he was doing, and to help support him in that. If it were today, she might have had her own career too, but. But in any case, she was a fantastic support to him, and a host of his friends at the home in Old Lyme, Connecticut. And the house was always filled with ornithologists and birders and other natural history personalities. His third wife, Virginia Westervelt, unfortunately, he. You know, after about 30 years of marriage, he and Barbara got a divorce. I guess their certain things had worn thin, and it's tough because being as devoted to his career as he was, appears to have gotten to be too much. And so then Virginia Westervelt was his third wife, and she was with him until he passed away in 1996.
Yeah, and we can talk about that a little bit later on as we go along, the third wife as well. Talking today with Elizabeth Rosenthal, whose book, Birdwatcher, The Life of Roger Torrey Peterson, is a really interesting read. And you may have some questions for her about Roger Torrey Peterson or about the guides. We've got so many things we can talk about. Wildlife as art is one thing I want to bring up with you, and I know you address it a bit in your book, too.
Yeah.
Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page, titled The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, though, dealing with the book Birdwatcher, The Life of Roger Torrey Peterson, with our guest Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's written a wonderful book. I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Maybe are you a fan of the Peterson Guide? or maybe you have a memory using a Peterson Field Guide. Love to hear about your experiences. Again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. He got himself involved. He's an advocate for wonderful things. I mean, he fought for the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. He was quite an environmentalist.
The Migratory Bird Treaty Act, that was he was still a kid at the time when that was enacted in the 19-teens.
He was an advocate of it, I should say. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right. But he did get involved in a lot of different conservation controversies, especially DDT. Actually, was probably the biggest fight, getting it banned because it was thinning eggshells of certain birds who were at the top of the bird food chain, like ospreys and bald eagles and peregrine falcons. And it took a while to determine what was going wrong, but it was very difficult, and it must have taken at least 15 or 18 years until, you know, Richard Nixon's administration banned DDT. And also enacted the Endangered Species Act and established the Environmental Protection Agency. But in any case, you know, he was studying the ospreys who were living on or about Great Island and along the Connecticut River near his home in Old Lyme, and he had young proteges who were also watching the osprey and seeing their numbers plummet year after year after year. It was horrible. Fortunately, he wasn't the only one who was concerned. But speaking of a Wisconsin connection,
yeah, Joe Hickey,
Joe Hickey, his very good friend from his days in the Bronx County Bird Club back in the 20s and early 30s, and Joe Hickey ended up becoming a professor of wildlife management at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he was a protege of Aldo Leopold, who wrote that seminal book, Sand County Almanac. In any case, Joe Hickey was kind of between a rock and a hard place because he could see what was happening, what the effect of DDT was on birds. But there were, you know, agricultural interests that also had influence at the University of Wisconsin, as well as many, many other universities across the country. So there was a lot of resistance and pushback to studying the effect of DDT on birds. But Roger ended up getting funding for a special international emergency conference about DDT and the peregrine falcon, and that took place in Madison in 1965. And that's where the issues and the things that they had to look at were solidified. And then within 3 years, it was determined that it was the phenomenon of eggshell thinning that DDT caused that prevented eggs from hatching, or prevented young from hatching. So that was a very dramatic time, and it was something that Roger and Joe ended up being able to work on closely, and it all happened in Madison.
Yep, all happened in Madison. I knew Joe Hickey and interviewed him a few times.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
wow.
I was lucky guy that I was, because he was quite a man. He was quite a guy. So I'm forever grateful for that. Had a chance to meet him and talk with him. So he's one of the. That's a great Wisconsin connection. Of course, Owen Grammy's another kind of Wisconsin connection, you might call. And especially, I was thinking of John and Alice Forrester,
right,
from Wausau.
Right, right, and the Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum. And,
One of the great, it is a just, I don't know if you've been there.
No, I haven't actually.
Oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful place. But tell us a story of how Roger became involved with it.
Well, back in the 70s, he had started chomping at the bit about using his art skills to paint what he called painterly painting and not just only draw pictures for field guides, because he felt he had the talent and he wanted credit, he wanted recognition for his artistic abilities. And so he went, his old friend Bob Lewin, who had established this company called the Mill Pond Press, was going to be issuing limited edition as well as regular prints of wildlife and from many artists, many wildlife artists, including Roger. And eventually that led to his coming together in the very early days with the Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum when it was in its infancy. And he was there for the first, what eventually would become the Birds in Art exhibit that became an annual event. The other Wisconsin connection was George H. Harrison, not to be confused with George Harrison the Beatle, who is a birding guru in his own right and was actually a protege of Roger's. He was essentially the impresario who put together these Birds in Art events and got the artists to come in, including Roger. And Roger absolutely loved it. He loved the fact that his art could be on display and be admired for its own sake and not even for educational purposes per se. And he loved getting to know the other artists, including Owen Gromme. And he loved the adulation and attention too.
Well, sure.
As a matter of fact, I think it was also an annual event to provide an award to a different artist each year. And so Roger got his award. I think it was first Owen Gromme, and then it was George Mitch Sutton. And then Roger got this special award at the museum event. And then Roger started being the one to present the award to different people, including Kent Ulberg and Robert Bateman, among other great artists. It was something that I think brought out a latent interest of his, which was, again, painterly painting. It's a shame that he didn't have the opportunity. Well, it's a shame that he didn't have more of an opportunity to do more of that, because he was always revising his field guides.
Yeah, it was so good. You know what, I never quite understood why people would not look at those individual paintings of birds that he did for the field guide as art.
Well, yeah, you know what, I'm not an art... I'm not schooled in art per se, although
no.
I do appreciate it, but it seems like there is this distinction that people make between illustration and actual art, and perhaps it has to do with whether it's something that comes out of your own inspiration or whether you're just copying or doing something for a purpose other than just creating beauty. That was something that Roger was sort of always puzzled about and frustrated about, that because he whether it was the field guide art or even his paintings of individual birds, he didn't understand why he wasn't more accepted, or he felt he wasn't more accepted as a true artist. But I think he was more accepted than he realized.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, he was so passionate. I think it was the second edition of his book. He completely redid the second edition from the first, if I'm not mistaken.
Well,
he rewrote it, I know. And
Eastern Guide, yeah. The first edition, well, of course, was in 1933.
Yeah.
And then the second actually was in 39. And then the third was in 47. And then the fourth one, which was the controversial one, came out in 1980. And, yeah, each time he redid paintings, sometimes he did all the plates over. In fact, as time went on, you know, the plates that he did for the original first edition were completely, I guess, outdated and sort of primitivistic. So he actually, in a way, it was a strange thing. He was actually moving toward more detail rather than less detail. But and so it was always a fine line between, you know, providing too much or too little. And then his many of his protégés and other people who had been inspired by him took him to task for the fourth edition, because they actually felt that it didn't have enough detail. Even though it was much more detailed, that it was either incorrect, or, you know, the different body parts were wrong, or he didn't have any idea about the advancements in birding that had taken place. And actually, none of that was true. I think it was just a question of a philosophical difference in terms of what you would include in a field guide that's supposed to educate the general public, as opposed to something for people who are already experts in the field. And that's where the conflict was. But the good thing that came out of that was he ended up becoming quite friendly with some of the people who had been extremely critical of the fourth edition, including Ken Kaufman, who, of course, you know, is a great name in birding today.
Right.
And he says that, you know, at the time he wrote a rather scathing review of the fourth edition, he hadn't really thought about Roger actually reading it, but Roger did read it, because he read everything.
Yeah.
And
he would certainly read a review of his own work.
But Ken also realized that, again, he began to understand Roger's outlook, which was, let's try to bring people into birding. The objective is to bring birds to as many people as possible, so that they will appreciate them, enjoy them, and care about them, which ultimately would have a good conservationist impact.
You know, I was just, as I was reading your book and thinking of, as you were writing about how, what the thoughts were that he had putting work into these guides, and color, it was an example. There's a time or two where you're talking about him getting the colors just right.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about it, yeah, I guess you really need to get those the right hue of red or yellow.
Right, right. And what's amazing is that it was always a judgment call. It was always a challenging judgment call to decide what to include in the bird or not in the field guide. You know, what to include so that it helps people, and what not to include. I do think that he always included just the right amount of information, both visually and via the written word. But it was again something that others eventually, after he'd been around for a few decades, took him to task over. And in fact, that happened also with the his field guide to wildflowers.
Yeah.
In fact, people don't realize. I mean, he edited a whole series. Well, some people may not realize he edited a whole series of natural history field guides, and he did the wildflower one that actually took several decades, because he actually had to go in the field and find all these different wildflowers and draw them from life. And so he was always doing that in between all his other projects, and so it didn't come out until I think it was the 60s. But even there, you know, he had people who were considered themselves botanists who said, well, it's a total insult to draw flowers in that way. he grouped them wrong. He grouped them all wrong. I mean, for example, he grouped them according to color. He thought that would be helpful to people. So he didn't group them according to the taxonomic categories. And so, you know, you had people who said, well, it's just wrong. It's just bad. And I learned my botany the hard way. Well, that's the whole point. You don't want people to learn botany the hard way. You want them to understand it sooner rather than later.
That's exactly right. Dan in Merrimack, let's go to you. Dan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, great. And what a wonderful topic.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi. I have a real close connection to J.J. Hickey.
Huh?
Okay.
He was my parents' neighbor when I was growing up.
Wow. That's wonderful.
I spent many an hour helping his wife peg band birds.
Oh, band birds?
Oh.
Oh, well, there's a... Dan, thanks for that comment. The whole business about Joe Hickey meeting his wife, Roger had a role in that to some extent, did he not?
Yeah, well, Roger liked to say that he knew Peggy before Joe knew Peggy, and they were all sort of... this was during a time when they would be birding in Connecticut in the early 40s, and it does seem like he thought, whether it's true or not, he thought that he had put them together.
Dan, thanks a lot for that. I appreciate it. So there's somebody who knew Joe. That's a long time. Dan's, yeah, that's a long, long time back. We had a Facebook comment from William who says, using my dog as an excuse to take nature walks, I get to see a lot of birds through all the seasonal changes. Mm-hmm. I also take slow drives through the countryside to enjoy the different aspects of bird habitat. Every once in a while, I get to see something that amuses me. Nothing like seeing young birds coming into their adult plumage. And yes, the Peterson Guide is a go-to book for identification, along with my many friends who are birders as well. Kind of a nice comment. And I wanted to bring it up because it reminded me of another story you told in the book about Roger was in a car. They were driving along, and the window was down or something, and he suddenly...
Yeah.
It was noisy. And,
yes. Yeah, that was... I think Pete Dunne told that story. A lot of people will know Pete Dunne, too, because he's a very prolific writer about birds, and until recently was the director of the Cape May Bird Observatory. So he got to know Roger in Roger's later years, and... Roger competed in the World Series of Birding in Cape May on several occasions. And so there was one time when they were all, I guess, in a station wagon, and the window was down, and it was kind of windy. And suddenly, and this is, Roger by this time was well into his 70s, and he said, "Morning warbler." And nobody else had heard it, and they were all several decades younger than he was. And so, but they were able to confirm that.
They stopped the car.
Yeah, right, yeah. But he was the one who heard it with the wind, you know, blowing through the windows, and he was in his 70s. So he had quite an amazing ear which was really sort of like a natural wonder in itself.
His, you know, and it was, as long as we're into his 70s, he went into his 90s, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And
almost
made it.
He almost did, yeah. He wasn't quite 88 when he passed away on July 28th, 1996. But he had planned to live till, you know, 105, 120. And he was working till his last day. He was revising. He was doing more revisions of the Eastern Guide that eventually came out as a fifth edition posthumously.
I'm just so amazed, and I think he won or received pretty much every major American award for natural science, for ornithology, conservation.
That and internationally, too.
Yeah.
He was even decorated by the King of Sweden.
Yeah. I know he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah. And he was a finalist. He didn't quite get there, but he was a finalist, which is an honor in itself.
Yeah, and, well, he said he couldn't figure out why they didn't anybody nominate him for it.
Yeah.
At some point, but I think it was a well-deserved nomination for sure. You think about what to you, what stands out to you the most about Roger Torrey Peterson?
Well, it's hard because he was such a multifaceted individual. He had so many different abilities. And one thing we haven't talked about much is that he was also a public speaker. And, you know, for decades, going, say, from the time he was working for the National Association of Audubon Societies all the way up till the 90s, he gave regular presentations on birds and conservation issues, you know, galvanizing the troops for different causes. I think what stands out for me is that everything that he did in his life really was for one purpose, ultimately, and that was appreciation of birds, birds and bird life, and making the world continue to be a hospitable place for birds, despite the encroachments of humanity. All his different endeavors went toward that goal.
You know, I think that's pretty well said. I was kind of thinking along those same lines myself, and I think I'm a busy person myself, but then I look at what he did,
uh-huh.
and I think, man, I'm a piker compared to this guy. He was just a, and so are 99.9% of all the people in the world, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just such a prodigious.
Yeah. Well, he was extremely ambitious, too, because, also underlying his love of birds was his need to achieve.
Yeah.
And there was always something else that he hadn't had a chance to do that he wished he could do, you know, whether it was write more books. I mean, he wrote a number of standards, including Wild America, which actually he co-wrote with James Fisher, his close friend from Britain. But you know, he kept wanting to perfect the field guides, write more books, see more places, do more paintings, eventually it's time took its toll, and by the end he was just only really working on the field guide revisions.
Well, Elizabeth, I have to say this has been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I've really enjoyed your book, and I'm hoping is it doing well on this republish?
It's hard to say. It's still too early to say.
Yeah, it's pretty early in the process.
Yeah, it is early in the process, but I've been getting some good interest, in fact, I'll be speaking at the unveiling. Well, it's not really an unveiling, but an event that in Connecticut, in Old Lyme, Connecticut, in October. In the furtherance of a Roger Torrey Peterson Estuary Center on the Connecticut River. And that's a real honor, and that came out of the blue.
Oh, man. Well, that's wonderful, Elizabeth, and you've earned that. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. I really had a good time.
Yeah, it was fun. Elizabeth Rosenthal. Published a lot. She's published birding articles in, Birdwatcher's Digest, New Jersey Audubon, Snowy Egret, and is the author of Birdwatcher, The Life of Roger Torrey Peterson, now out in soft cover. And I'm trying to look at find the price here. Well, I'll tell you what. Go to our Facebook page. I don't see it right here. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We've got a link to it. And I'm pretty sure you're going to enjoy reading about it. This was a really interesting guy who did so much for me and for you and everybody. Well, coming up now, We're going to talk a little bit. We're going to switch gears here. You know, I like a glass. I had a glass of wine last night at the end of the day, as a matter of fact, with the next door neighbor. We sat on the porch and had a glass of wine after dinner. And we're going to talk a little bit about wine and also talk about spirits like brandy. There is a new distillery at Wallersheim Winery, and Philippe Cocard is going to tell us all about it. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.